Before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. If you're studying for the Series 82, they've got like a full course with adaptive quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. It's super helpful. Check them out at certfuel.com.
Yeah, it's honestly an essential tool when you're staring down a massive regulatory framework.
Right. And speaking of massive regulatory frameworks, that is exactly our mission today. We are pulling from a huge stack of sources, SEC bulletins, legal outlines, and basically the most heavily tested concepts from Series 82 prep materials. And our target.
Yeah.
Regulation D.
Oh, yeah. The B.
Literally the apex predator of Function 1. If you're listening to this, you know Function 1 is half of your entire exam.
It's huge.
Yeah, but we aren't just going to, read you a list of rules to memorize. We need to dissect how these rules actually work in the real world, because that's how you survive the trick questions on exam day.
Exactly. I mean, memorization only gets you so far, right? The exam writers, they know exactly how to twist a scenario just enough that if you don't understand the underlying mechanism, like the actual why behind the rule, you will totally pick the distractor answer.
Which is why we're going to rely on a recurring cast of characters today. We're going to build a little cinematic universe of securities law just to make the abstract stuff concrete for you.
I love this approach.
Yeah, it works. Right. So first up, we have Sam, the sponsor. Sam is our entrepreneur. He's got this brilliant but slightly chaotic business idea. Let's say he's building blockchain-enabled toasters.
Naturally.
Right, that's Raleigh. And he desperately needs to raise capital. But he wants to avoid the multi-million dollar nightmare of a full SEC registration. Next, we have Ingrid, the investor. She's incredibly wealthy, heavily connected, and just always hunting for a lucrative private placement.
So Ingrid represents the capital liquidity that Sam requires to actually get his toasters to market.
Exactly. And finally, stuck right in the middle of these two, we have Riley the rep. Riley is the broker. His job is basically to look at Sam's wild ambitions and Ingrid's massive checkbook and structure a deal that keeps everyone out of federal prison.
A very important job.
Very. So, okay, let's unpack this. Why does this framework even exist? Before we can talk about the specific rules of Regulation D, we really have to look at the massive brick wall that allows you to bypass.
Yeah, and that brick wall is the Securities Act of 1933.
The big one.
Right. Following the stock market crash of 1929, Congress basically established a baseline default rule for the whole American financial system.
Which was?
If you want to sell a security to the public, you absolutely must register it with the Securities and Exchange Commission.
And full registration is an exhaustive, brutal process, right?
Oh, it's a nightmare. It requires audited financial statements, massive legal disclosures, an S-1 filing, and literally months of waiting for SEC approval.
So for a behemoth corporation like, I don't know, Apple or Ford,
yeah,
that process is just the cost of doing business.
Sure, they can afford it.
But for Sam, the sponsor, just a guy in a garage trying to build a prototype toaster.
It would be a complete death sentence. I mean, the legal and auditing fees alone would bankrupt his toaster company before he even sold a single share.
Right. Completely unfeasible.
Exactly. And Congress recognized this. They realized that if they forced every single startup to go through full registration, capital formation in the United States would basically just grind to a halt.
So they created statutory exemptions. Pathways around the brick wall.
Exactly.
And Regulation D is basically the crown jewel of those pathways. But I want to frame how we think about this exemption, because this is where test takers make their very first critical error.
Yeah, it's a big one.
So I see Reg D as like a VIP pass at a heavily guarded rock concert. The VIP pass lets you walk right past the massive general admission line, which represents that grueling SEC registration process. You get straight into the venue.
A great feeling.
Totally. But, and this is key holding, that VIP pass does not give you permission to walk over to the merchandise table, steal a bunch of t-shirts, and punch the lead singer.
That is a remarkably accurate analogy. I mean, the VIP pass excuses you from the waiting line, right? Not from the law itself.
Exactly.
So in securities terminology, Regulation D exempts an offering from registration only. It absolutely does not exempt Sam, the sponsor, from anti-fraud laws or civil liability.
Exam trap alert right here.
Ugh.
I am explicitly flagging this for you, the listener. The test writers love this concept. If a question tells you Regulation D exempts an offering from anti-fraud liability, it is lying to you.
Just think about the underlying logic of the SEC. Their mandate is investor protection. They are willing to let Sam skip the registration paperwork to save some money.
Right, to help startups.
Yeah, But they are never going to give him a license to lie. If Sam pitches his company to Ingrid and he conveniently omits a massive material fact.
Like the fact that his prototype toasters occasionally burst into flames?
Right, exactly like that. If he omits that, he has committed securities fraud. The fact that he used a Regulation D exemption to bypass the paperwork is entirely irrelevant to the fraud charge.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. An issuer must always, without exception, avoid material misstatements and omissions.
So you bypass the red tape, but you can never bypass the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. I want to throw a hypothetical at you to test another boundary of this VIP pass. Actually, I'm going to ask you, the listener, a direct question. Think through the logic here. I'll give you a beat to answer in your head.
Okay, let's hear it.
Let's say Sam successfully uses Regulation D to sell shares to Ingrid. A month later, Ingrid decides she wants some liquid cash. So she turns around and offers to sell those exact same shares to her Wilson. Can Ingrid claim a Regulation D exemption for her sale? Think about it. No, she cannot.
The answer is definitively no.
Yeah.
And the reason is that Regulation D is an issuer exemption.
Right. It belongs exclusively to Sam.
Exactly. Sam, the sponsor, the entity actually creating and issuing the securities.
But wait, the shares themselves were born in a Reg D offering. Shouldn't the exemption, like, travel with the stock?
I get why you'd think that, but it doesn't work that way. The SEC grants the exemption based on the circumstances of the primary capital raise.
Okay.
Once the securities are in Ingrid's hands, they are what we call restricted. If she wants to engage in a secondary market transaction, meaning reselling them to someone else, she has to find her own completely separate exemption in the rule book.
Which is usually Rule 144, right?
Usually, yes.
Yeah.
That governs the resale of restricted stock, but she absolutely cannot borrow Sam's Regulation D pass. It is strictly non-transferable.
That distinction is huge. It applies to the issuer, not the affiliate, not the investor. Now, we are talking a lot about the SEC, which is the federal government, but we know every single state has its own securities regulator enforcing their own blue sky laws.
Oh, yeah.
Does Sam just hold up his federal Reg D paperwork and tell the state of California to leave him alone?
Yeah. Attempting to tell a state regulator to back off is generally a terrible business strategy.
I can imagine.
Regulation D does not obliterate state securities laws. They operate concurrently.
Okay, side by side.
Right. Now, under specific provisions of Reg D that we'll discuss shortly, federal law does preempt certain state-level registration requirements.
Oh, it does?
It does. But even with that federal preemption, the states retain immense power. They still require notice filings, they still demand filing fees, and they absolutely retain their own independent anti-fraud authority.
So you're playing on a dual jurisdiction chessboard.
Perfectly said, yes.
Okay. What if Sam makes an honest mistake? Let's say he aims for a specific Reg D exemption. He fills out all the paperwork, but his lawyer just botches a technical condition. Is Sam permanently banned from raising capital? Like, is his company dead?
Not necessarily. Choosing to use Regulation D is not an exclusive election.
What does that mean?
Well, Reg D is what we call a safe harbor. Imagine a treacherous, rocky coastline that represents the muddy waters of securities law.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
The SEC has dredged a very specific, clearly marked channel through those rocks. That channel is Reg D. If you stay between the buoys, you have absolute certainty that you won't hit a rock. You are safe from registration requirements.
But what if you drift outside the buoy?
If you drift outside, you lose the absolute protection of the safe harbor, but you haven't necessarily sunk the ship.
Okay, so what's the backup plan?
Sam could still attempt to rely on the general statutory exemption for private offerings, which is under Section 4A2 of the Securities Act.
Is that easy to do?
Not at all. Proving a Section 4A2 exemption is vastly more difficult. It requires a really complex facts and circumstances analysis, basically proving the investors didn't need the protection of the act.
Yikes.
Yeah, but the point is, failing a technical Reg D requirement doesn't automatically vaporize every other legal defense available to him.
Okay, let me push back on that, though. What if Sam isn't making an honest mistake? What if Riley the rep and Sam sit down in a dimly lit room and engineer this hyper-complex legal structure?
Uh-oh.
Right. They create shell companies, they use proxy buyers, and they design an offering that technically checks every single box of Regulation D on paper. But the actual reality of the situation is that they are quietly funneling unregistered stock to the general retail public.
A classic scheme.
Exactly. If the paperwork is flawless, does the SEC have to respect the exemption?
No. The SEC is not a computer program that just reads checkboxes. They look at the economic reality of the transaction.
The reality. not just the paper.
Exactly. Regulation D contains a very explicit scheme caveat. The exemption is unavailable for any transaction or chain of transactions that, although in technical compliance with the rules, is part of a plan or scheme to evade the registration requirements.
So if you act like a cartoon villain with a fake mustache, technical compliance will not save you. The SEC will pierce right through the illusion and hit you with an unregistered offering violation.
Precisely. The spirit of the law matters just as much as the letter of the law when we're talking about evasion.
Got it. Let's get into the mechanics. When you strip away all the dense statutory language, Regulation D really offers issuers two main pathways, two major playgrounds where capital is raised.
Yep.
On the exam, these are known as Rule 504 and Rule 506B. Let's tackle Rule 504 first. The industry usually just calls this the small offering exemption, right?
And for very good reason. The defining characteristic of Rule 504 is its strict dollar ceiling. Under this exemption, Sam the sponsor can raise a maximum of $10
million. $10 million. Okay, let's stress test how they calculate that number, because I know the SEC doesn't leave room for creative accounting. The rule says $10 million is the aggregate offering price. Break that down for me.
Yeah.
If Sam wants to hit that cap, is it just $10 million in physical cash handed over in a briefcase?
No, the SEC defines the aggregate offering price as the sum of all consideration the issuer receives for the securities.
All consideration.
Right. Cash is obviously included, but it goes much further than that.
Let's play this out with an absurd scenario. Let's say Sam wants to raise his $10 million. Ingrid writes him a check for $8 million.
Hmm.
So Sam is sitting at $8 million in cash. He has $2 million left in his cap.
Cracking.
Then Riley the rep finds another investor. This investor doesn't have any cash, but he owns a massive marina. He says, Sam, I will give you my entire fleet of slightly used jet skis, and in exchange, you give me $1 million worth of stock in your toaster company.
Okay, jet skis.
Right. And then a third investor chimes in. This person loaned Sam $1 million 3 years ago. The investor says, let's just cancel that old debt, and you give me $1 million in stock today. So my question for you, listener, do the jet skis and the canceled debt count toward that $10 million small offering limit?
Think about the SEC's definition.
Yeah. And the answer is?
They absolutely do. This is a critical concept for the exam. Property, services, notes, and canceled debt all count toward the aggregate offering price.
So we can't just ignore the jet skis.
No. The SEC requires Sam to determine the fair market value of those non-cash assets. So the fair market value of those jet skis is added to the tally.
And the debt.
The face value of the canceled debt is added to the tally too. Sam cannot bypass the $10 million ceiling by treating his stock like a bartering token. If he did, he would have blown the exemption.
Exam trap alert. I want you to burn the number $10 million into your memory. If you are using legacy study materials from a few years ago, or if you talk to a senior broker who took their licensing exams a decade ago, they might confidently tell you the Rule 504 limit is $5 million or even $1 million.
Yeah, that's a huge issue with old material.
You're not listening to them. The SEC updated this rule. The ceiling is exactly $10 million. If you see $5 million as an option on a multiple choice question, treat it as a malicious distractor and immediately cross it out.
It is a very common trap. And, you know, it's not just a flat $10 million per offering. There is a timeline attached to that cap. It is a rolling 12-month look back.
Walk me through the math on that rolling look back. How does Sam calculate his available space?
Let's say Sam wants to start a new Rule 504 offering today. To find out how much of his $10 million cap is actually available, he has to look back exactly 12 months from today's start date.
Okay, 12 months.
He must subtract the aggregate offering price of any securities he sold under the same Rule 504 exemption during that previous 12-month window. He also has to deduct any securities he sold in violation of the SEC's registration requirements during that time.
So Sam raised $4 million under Rule 504 6 months ago, and he opens a new offering today. He can only raise $6 million today.
Correct. The 12-month window is constantly moving forward.
That makes sense. It prevents Sam from doing a $10 million raise on Monday, closing it, and then opening another $10 million raise on Friday, pretending they're separate deals.
Exactly.
Now, is anyone allowed to use this $10 million shortcut? Are there companies that are just blacklisted from the Rule 504 playground?
Yes. There are specific outcasts. The SEC permanently bans three types of companies from using this small offering exemption, regardless of how small the deal actually is.
Okay, who's the first?
First, Exchange Act reporting companies.
By reporting companies, you mean massive public companies.
Exactly. Companies that are already trading publicly and are required to file comprehensive annual 10-K and quarterly 10-Q reports with the SEC. If you are already in the public reporting ecosystem, you don't get to use the small business shortcut.
Who is the second outcast?
Investment companies. So a mutual fund or a unit investment trust cannot use Rule 504 to raise capital.
Makes sense.
And the third, which is historically the most heavily tested, are blank check or development stage companies.
What makes a company a blank check? It sounds like something out of a 1990s movie.
It does, right. A blank check company is a development stage entity that either has no specific business plan or purpose, or its only stated business plan is to merge with or acquire an unidentified company at some point in the future.
So Sam basically sets up an LLC and says, give me $10 million. I have no idea what I'm going to do with it. I don't build anything. I don't provide a service. But trust me, eventually I'll buy something cool.
That is the textbook definition. And the reason the SEC blacklists them from Rule 504 is historical.
What happened?
Well, in the past, microcap fraudsters would use small offering exemptions to pump up blank check shell companies, issue millions of penny stocks, and then basically dump them on unsuspecting retail investors.
Oh, a pump and dump.
Exactly. Because these companies have no actual operations, they are incredibly susceptible to manipulation. So the SEC simply shut the door. If you are a blank check company, you cannot use Rule 504.
Oops, dropped my pen there. Sorry. But hey, listen up, because we are pivoting to the second exemption. So that was the small offering world, capped at $10 million, rolling 12-month look back, no blank check companies.
Right.
But what if Sam's ambition outgrows that sandbox? What if his prototype toaster goes viral, he gets massive institutional interest, and he suddenly needs to raise $500 million to build a global manufacturing facility?
Rule 504 is useless to him then.
Right. Does Regulation D offer a path for a $500 million raise without SEC registration?
It absolutely does. This leads us to the second major pathway. Rule 506B, universally known as the No Solicitation Private Placement.
Okay, Rule 506.
Under this rule, the dollar ceiling completely vanishes. Sam can raise $500 million, he can raise $5 billion. There is no aggregate offering price limit whatsoever.
Unlimited money. But the SEC doesn't just hand out a blank check for $1 billion without extracting a massive pound of flesh. What is the trade-off for having the dollar limit removed?
The trade-off is brutal silence. In exchange for unlimited capital, Sam must accept a strict, uncompromising ban on general solicitation and general advertising.
Define general solicitation for me. If Sam wants to raise $500 million, how is he supposed to find the money if he can't talk about it?
General solicitation means you cannot broadcast the offering to the public at large. Sam cannot buy a billboard on the highway. He cannot run a television commercial.
In the ads. Okay.
Right. He cannot set up an unrestricted website that anyone can click on to read his pitch deck. He cannot buy a list of phone numbers and have Riley the rep cold call strangers.
So how does he do it?
He must raise that $500 million quietly, almost exclusively through pre-existing substantive relationships.
I want to make sure the contrast between these two rules is incredibly sharp for the listener. Let's do a direct side-by-side comparison. Rule 504, the small offering exemption, does it have a dollar limit?
Yes, $10 million.
Can you use general solicitation under Rule 504?
As a general baseline, no. The ban on general solicitation applies to 504 as well.
Okay, so they're the same there.
Mostly, but, and this is a nuance, there are very narrow state law exceptions where Rule 504 allows public advertising, such as when the offering is registered in a state that requires the delivery of a substantive disclosure document. But for the bulk of the exam, assume it bans general solicitation unless they specifically trigger one of those state law caveats.
Okay, got it. Now, Rule 506B, the no solicitation, private placement,
yeah.
Dollar limit.
None. General solicitation.
Absolutely prohibited. Zero exceptions.
So the fundamental tension in Regulation D seems to be size versus silence.
That's a great way to put it. But wait, I'm thinking about how the modern internet works. What if Sam is a phenomenal marketer? What if his entire superpower is going viral on social media? He wants to raise unlimited money, but he also desperately wants to buy a billboard in Times Square and run targeted ads on financial websites. Is he just entirely locked out of Regulation D?
Historically, yes, he was totally locked out. But the landscape changed dramatically with the JOBS Act of 2012, which directed the SEC to create a modern solution.
Oh, nice. What's the solution?
That solution is Rule 506C. Let's call it the accredited-only exemption. This rule fundamentally alters the physics of Regulation D. I like to visualize Rule 506B and this new Rule 506C as sitting on opposite ends of a seesaw.
I love a good mechanical analogy. Walk me through the seesaw.
Sure. On one side of the seesaw, you have the traditional no solicitation rule we just discussed, Rule 506B. Because Sam agrees to keep his mouth shut publicly, The SEC affords him a certain level of leniency regarding who can invest. He can bring in an unlimited number of wealthy accredited investors, but he is also allowed to bring in up to 35 non-accredited everyday retail investors, provided they meet certain sophistication standards we'll cover later.
So the silence buys him the flexibility to include a small crowd of regular people.
Exactly.
Okay, so silence gets you 35 non-accredited slots. What is sitting on the other side of the seesaw?
On the other side is Rule 506C, the accredited only exemption. Under this rule, the ban on general solicitation is entirely lifted.
Really?
Yeah. Sam can buy the Times Square billboard. He can run full-page newspaper ads. He can scream about his toaster company from the rooftops.
That sounds incredible for a startup founder. What is the counterweight? What is the heavy catch on that side of the seesaw?
The catch is absolute unforgiving exclusivity. In exchange for the right to advertise publicly, every single purchaser in the offering must be an accredited investor.
Every single one?
Yes. The SEC removes the 35-person allowance entirely. Zero non-accredited purchasers are permitted.
Let me pose a direct question to the listener. Mm. Visualize this scenario. Sam buys his billboard. He blasts out his social media campaign under Rule 506C. Mm. He successfully collects 50 massive checks from verified, ultra-wealthy, accredited investors.
So far, so good.
Right. But then, Sam's old college roommate calls him up. The roommate is a middle school teacher, definitely not a millionaire, definitely not accredited. He begs Sam to let him buy just one single share for $500 so he can be part of the journey. Sam thinks, what is the harm? It's one guy and he's my friend.
Yeah.
Sam accepts the $500 and issues the share. So what happens to Sam's multi-million dollar exemption? Think about it for a second.
It's a harsh reality.
The entire exemption detonates.
It is completely destroyed. The presence of a single non-accredited buyer in an offering that utilized general solicitation causes the seesaw to just crash to the ground.
Right.
Sam just conducted an unregistered public offering, and he is now staring down the barrel of severe SEC enforcement and rescission offers for every single investor.
That is terrifyingly strict. And I assume the SEC doesn't just let Sam use the honor system, right?
Yeah.
If someone clicks on Sam's Facebook ad and fills out a web form saying, yeah, I'm totally a millionaire, trust me, Sam can't just take their word for it.
No. The honor system is dead under Rule 506C. The SEC imposes an affirmative duty on the issuer. If Sam uses general solicitation, he must take reasonable steps to verify that every single purchaser is actually an accredited investor.
What does reasonable steps to verify look like in practice? Does Riley the rep have to hire a private investigator to audit their lives?
It doesn't require a private investigator, but it does require hard documentation. It typically involves reviewing IRS forms like W-2s or tax returns to verify income over the past 2 years.
Okay, so real paperwork.
Right. Or reviewing bank statements, brokerage accounts, and property appraisals, minus liabilities like credit reports, to verify net worth. Alternatively, Sam can obtain a written confirmation from a registered broker-dealer, a registered investment advisor, a licensed attorney, or a CPA, stating that they have taken reasonable steps to verify the purchaser's status within the last 3 months.
But the key takeaway for the exam is that self-certification is never enough. A simple check-the-box questionnaire where the investor pinky swears they are rich is legally insufficient if you ran public ads.
Exactly. And if you understand the SEC's motivation, this makes total sense.
Why is that?
Well, if you are operating quietly through private networks, the risk of a vulnerable person getting swindled is relatively low. But the moment you start blasting investment opportunities to the general public, the risk of catching unsophisticated, vulnerable people in your net skyrockets.
Oh, for sure.
The SEC says, fine, blast your ads, but we are shifting the burden of proof entirely onto you to ensure that the people who walk through the door can afford to lose every penny they invest.
Okay, let's leave the advertising world and go back to the quiet world. Let's return to Rule 506B, the no solicitation private placement. We established that if Sam keeps his mouth shut, he is allowed to have an unlimited number of accredited investors, plus a maximum of 35 non-accredited investors.
Yes, the 35 allowance.
This brings us to the mechanics of counting heads. Because the way the SEC counts to 35 is not how normal humans count to 35.
It really isn't.
There is a massive exam trap hiding in the timeline of this rule. How exactly is that 35 purchaser limit applied?
The rule is not an absolute lifetime cap. The specific regulation dictates that the issuer may sell to no more than 35 non-accredited purchasers in any 90 calendar day period.
Exam trap alert. I cannot stress this enough. If a multiple choice question says under Rule 506B, Sam can sell to a maximum of 35 non-accredited purchasers ever in the life of his company, that statement is factually wrong. The 90-day window is the critical metric.
It's also vital to note the language of the regulation. The rule is satisfied if the issuer reasonably believes there are no more than 35 such purchasers.
So there's a little leeway there.
A little. If Sam and Riley the rep implement a rigorous, well-documented counting procedure, and a purchaser engages in elaborate fraud to bypass it in a way Sam couldn't have reasonably detected, the SEC generally won't retroactively destroy the exemption.
Okay.
But the baseline count is 35 heads in 90 days.
Let me challenge this entire framework, though. You hear about private equity funds and massive startup rounds that raise hundreds of millions of dollars from hundreds of different investors.
Yeah.
You cannot build a massive syndicate with only 35 people.
True.
How do these massive private placements exist without blowing the cap?
Because of who is legally invisible to the count.
Invisible.
Yeah. The SEC provides specific statutory exclusions. There are categories of people who can buy into the deal, hand over their money, or receive stock, and yet they count as a zero on Sam's 35-person tally.
Who gets to be invisible?
The most important category, accredited investors. Any purchaser who meets the accredited investor definition is entirely excluded from the count.
Oh.
This is how you build a 500-person private placement. If 480 of your investors are accredited and 20 are non-accredited, your official legal count for the rule is only 20.
So you are well under the 35-person limit.
Exactly. Sales to accredited investors are utterly limitless in a no-solicitation offering.
Okay, that explains the massive hedge funds. Who else is invisible? What about family?
Family dynamics provide another major exclusion, specifically regarding shared households. Any relative, spouse, or relative of the spouse who shares the same primary residence as the primary purchaser is excluded from the count.
They just get lumped in.
They're essentially absorbed into the primary purchaser for regulatory math.
I need to test this with a ridiculous scenario.
Let's hear it.
I want you to imagine Ingrid the investor. She lives in a sprawling, multi-wing mega mansion. Ingrid decides to invest in Sam's toaster company. She writes a check. Her husband, who lives with her in the mansion, thinks it's a great idea, so he writes a separate check from his own personal account.
Okay, two checks.
Then Ingrid's eccentric cousin Greg, who has been squatting in the guest house for the last 3 years, decides to buy in. And finally, Ingrid and her husband have a family trust. They collectively own 60% of the beneficial interest in this trust, and the trust itself buys a block of stock.
Quite the family affair.
Right. So in objective reality, Sam has received four completely separate checks from four different legal entities. How many purchasers does Sam tick off on his 35-person counter?
He ticks off exactly one.
One. Explain the mechanism behind that, because to a layman, that sounds like tax fraud.
It's not fraud. It's just the SEC recognizing economic units. Ingrid accounts as the primary purchaser. That's one. Her husband is a spouse sharing her primary residence, so he is excluded. The SEC views them as a single economic household.
What about cousin Greg?
Cousin Greg is a relative sharing the same primary residence, so he is also absorbed into Ingrid's count.
What about the trust? It's a completely separate legal entity.
The rule specifically dictates that a trust, estate, corporation, or other organization in which the purchaser and their residential relatives collectively hold more than 50% of the beneficial interest is treated as controlled by that purchaser.
And they own 60%.
Right. Since Ingrid and her husband own 60% of the trust, it gets absorbed too. The SEC looks at all four checks, traces them back to the same primary residence and control structure, and says that is one purchaser.
Fascinating. Let's talk about other entities like corporations. If a random corporate entity, let's call it Megacorp LLC, buys stock in Sam's deal, how does that count?
Generally, a corporation, partnership, or LLC counts as one single purchaser, regardless of how many shareholders or members are inside of it.
Okay. I smell a massive loophole.
Oh.
Listen to this scheme. I have 100 friends. None of us are accredited. We all really want to invest in Sam's deal, but we know he only has 35 slots left. So my 100 friends and I pool our cash. We form a brand new entity called Let's Buy Sam Stock LLC, and the LLC makes one massive purchase. Sam marks down one purchaser, we all get the economic benefit, and we beat the system.
Right.
Not even close. The SEC anticipated that exact loophole decades ago.
Did they?
Yeah. There is a specific anti-evasion exception. If an entity was formed for the specific purpose of acquiring the offered securities, and the entity in itself is not an accredited investor, the SEC will pierce the corporate veil.
Ouch.
Sam cannot count the LLC as one purchaser. He is legally required to rip the entity open and count every single beneficial owner inside as a separate purchaser.
So my clever LLC scheme suddenly hits Sam with 100 non-accredited purchasers, blowing past his 35 limit and destroying his entire Regulation D exemption.
Instantly. You cannot use a shell company as a Trojan horse to sneak a crowd of unaccredited retail investors into a private placement. Okay, what about institutional pools of money? Let's say a retirement plan wants to invest.
A non-contributory ERISA plan, which stands for the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, standard benefit plans, counts as one single purchaser, but only under the condition that the plan's trustee makes all the investment decisions for the plan.
What if we apply that logic to Riley the rep? Let's say Riley is an incredibly successful broker. He has 50 different retail clients. Every single one of those 50 clients has given Riley full discretionary authority over their accounts.
Okay, full discretion.
Right. Riley doesn't even need to call them. He just makes the trades. Riley evaluates Sam's company, decides it's a phenomenal buy, and executes a block trade for all 50 clients. Since Riley, one human being, made the solitary investment decision, does that count as one purchaser?
No, it does not. The rule is incredibly explicit here. An investment advisor's client or a broker-dealer's customer counts as a purchaser individually, regardless of the amount of discretion that client handed over to the advisor or the firm.
So Riley's 50 clients count as 50 separate purchasers.
Exactly. You cannot consolidate retail brokerage accounts into a single counting unit just because one broker is pulling the levers.
So the math is incredibly strict. Now let's look at the actual human beings we are counting. We established that under the no solicitation rule, Sam is allowed up to 35 non-accredited investors. But does that mean he can take money from any non-accredited person? If he has 10 slots left, can Sam just walk into a local dive bar, find 10 random people who have zero financial literacy, and sell them high-risk startup stock?
Absolutely not. The SEC doesn't just let anyone wander into a private market. This brings us to the concept of purchaser qualification.
What's that?
Well, if someone is an accredited investor, the regulatory assumption is that they have the financial resources to fend for themselves. But if someone is non-accredited, the rule mandates that they must be sophisticated.
Sophisticated? That sounds incredibly subjective.
Yep.
Define sophistication in the eyes of the SEC.
It's not about wearing a tailored suit.
Yeah.
Right. The legal standard requires that the purchaser must have sufficient knowledge and experience in financial and business matters, that they are capable of evaluating the merits and risks of the prospective investment. Alternatively, the issuer must reasonably believe they possess this capability immediately before the sale.
But what if they don't? Let's say Sam has an uncle. His uncle was a plumber for 40 years. He's retired. He's not accredited, and he openly admits he has no idea how to evaluate the financial merits of a blockchain-integrated hardware startup.
A very common situation.
But he wants to support his nephew and invest his savings. Is the uncle permanently locked out because he lacks sophistication?
Not permanently. The SEC provides a bridge. The uncle can borrow someone else's sophistication by utilizing a purchaser representative.
So the uncle hires an expert to evaluate the deal on his behalf.
Exactly. The rule states that the purchaser, together with their purchaser representative, must collectively possess that requisite financial knowledge and experience.
But wait, this feels ripe for a conflict of interest. Can Sam, the sponsor, say, "Hey, uncle, I know you don't understand these financial models, but don't worry, my chief financial officer will act as your purchaser representative and explain it to you."
That would be a massive illegal conflict of interest.
I figured.
The entire purpose of a purchaser representative is to serve as an independent shield for the unsophisticated buyer. Therefore, the regulations strictly dictate that the representative generally must not be an affiliate, a director, an officer, or an employee of the issuer.
That makes sense.
Furthermore, they cannot be a 10% or greater beneficial owner of the issuer.
Because if the representative works for Sam, they aren't going to critique Sam's deal. They're just going to rubber stamp it to get the uncle's money.
Precisely. Now, there is a very narrow, highly specific exception to that independence rule, and it involves deep family ties.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Can Riley, the rep, who happens to be an executive officer of the issuer, serve as a purchaser representative for his own mother? Yes. The SEC allows it if the purchaser is a relative by blood, marriage, or adoption, no more remote than a first cousin. It also extends to trusts or estates where those close relatives hold massive control. But outside of that family carve-out, independence is non-negotiable.
Exam trap alert. I am bringing the alarm bell again. The exam loves to test the paperwork surrounding this representative. The rule requires that the purchaser must acknowledge in writing that this specific person is their representative. But how does that document work? Can the uncle just sign a simple one-page letter that says, "Riley the rep is my purchaser representative for all private placements I ever do for the rest of my life"?
No. A standing blanket acknowledgement is an automatic failure.
Why is that?
The written acknowledgement signed by the purchaser must be specific to that exact investment transaction. It must explicitly state, "Riley is my representative for the evaluation and purchase of Sam's blockchain toaster Series A offering."
And what about the representative themselves? Do they have disclosure duties?
Yes, very strict ones. The representative must disclose to the purchaser, in writing, a reasonable time before the sale, any material relationship between themselves or their affiliates and the issuer or its affiliates.
Okay, that sounds pretty standard.
And the critical detail here is the look-back period. This disclosure must encompass any material relationship that exists now, or that existed at any time during the previous 2 years, or that is mutually understood to be contemplated.
2 years. So if Riley was paid a consulting fee by Sam 18 months ago, Riley has to put that in writing and hand it to the uncle before the uncle buys the stock.
Exactly. The uncle has the right to know if his independent advisor has been historically compensated by the guy selling the stock.
All right. So we've sorted out the people. We know who is allowed in, how to mathematically count them, and who is allowed to help them evaluate the deal. Now, let's zoom in on the actual transaction paperwork.
The fun stuff. Specifically, the delivery of information. When Sam sells this stock, there is a massive prospectus-like document, usually called a private placement memorandum, or PPM. Does Sam have to legally hand this massive stack of financial disclosures to every single person who buys a share?
This is a highly testable nuance. Under the strict letter of Regulation D, Sam is legally mandated to deliver that comprehensive written information only when he is selling under the no solicitation private placement exemption and only to a purchaser who is not an accredited investor.
Hold on, let me process that. So if Ingrid the investor, who is an accredited billionaire, buys into this deal, Sam is not legally required by Regulation D to give her the formal disclosure document.
Under the strict parameters of the exemption itself, no.
Really?
Really. The mandatory information delivery requirement attaches specifically to the non-accredited purchasers. The regulatory philosophy is that accredited investors have the leverage and resources to demand the information they need on their own, whereas non-accredited investors need the regulatory mandate to ensure they aren't kept in the dark. But wait, if Sam is already printing the massive document for his uncle, wouldn't it be incredibly foolish not to just hand a copy to Ingrid as well?
It would be incredibly foolish, and the SEC explicitly notes this. There is a specific note in the rule stating that if an issuer furnishes the mandated information to non-accredited purchasers, they should consider providing the exact same information to the accredited investors as well, primarily to mitigate any future anti-fraud claims.
Exam trap alert. Let's pause right here because the exam writers will weaponize the English language against you. You just said the rule states the issuer should consider giving it to the accredited investors.
That is the exact verbiage.
Listen to me very carefully. Do not let a multiple choice question trick you into thinking should consider is a synonym for must. If the exam asks, is Sam required by Rule 506B to deliver the disclosure document to accredited investors? The answer is undeniably no.
Right.
Should consider is a best practice recommendation. It is not a statutory mandate. The mandate only attaches to the non-accredited buyers.
It's a classic regulatory gotcha. The duty attaches to the classification of the individual buyer, not to the offering as a whole.
Okay, so for the people who do receive the mandatory paperwork, how deep do the financial statements have to go?
It scales based on the size of the company and the offering. If Sam's company is not already an Exchange Act reporting company, the level of audited financial statement detail required scales up significantly when the offering size crosses the $20 million threshold.
Okay, but even if the formal printed paperwork is only mandated for the unaccredited folks, isn't there a general right for all investors to just interrogate the founder?
Yes, and this is a distinctly separate right with a much broader application. In a no-solicitation private placement, the issuer must afford every single purchaser, regardless of whether they are accredited or non-accredited, the opportunity to ask questions and receive answers concerning the terms and conditions of the offering.
So they can grill him.
Absolutely. They also have the affirmative right to obtain any additional information the issuer possesses or can acquire without unreasonable effort or expense to verify the accuracy of the information they were given.
So the unaccredited uncle gets the mandatory 100-page brochure, but both the uncle and Ingrid, the billionaire, get to sit Sam in a chair and grill him in a Q&A session before handing over their checks.
Exactly. The Q&A right is universal.
Okay, let's fast forward. Everyone is happy. The Q&A goes well. Everyone buys the stock. 6 months pass. Sam's company is doing okay, but Ingrid decides she wants to buy a new yacht. She needs liquid cash. She looks at her portfolio and says, I'm just going to sell my Reg D shares.
Uh-oh.
This brings us to resale limits. I like to call this the Hotel California rule of private placements. You can check out anytime you like, but you can't easily leave.
The Hotel California analogy is perfect. With the exception of certain very specific state law paths under the small offering rule, securities acquired in a Regulation D transaction are classified as restricted securities.
What does the word restricted actually mean in practical terms?
It means they are legally locked up. They cannot be resold to the general public without either a full SEC registration, which Ingrid is not going to do, or a valid available exemption for the resale, which typically means navigating the complex holding periods of Rule 144.
So she's stuck.
Yeah, Ingrid cannot simply open her brokerage app and hit sell on the open market.
And does Sam have a responsibility to enforce that? Like, what if Sam sells the stock to Ingrid, knowing full well she is a highly impatient person who plans to illegally flip the shares to retail investors the very next day? Is Sam off the hook just because he handled the initial sale correctly?
Sam is absolutely not off the hook. The SEC forces the issuer to act as a gatekeeper.
How so?
The rule dictates that the issuer must exercise reasonable care to ensure that purchasers are not acting as statutory underwriters, meaning they aren't buying the stock solely with a view toward illegally distributing it to the public. If Sam turns a blind eye and facilitates a disguised public distribution, he loses his Regulation D exemption retroactively.
How does Sam prove to the SEC that he exercised reasonable care? What are the actual mechanics of that defense?
The regulation outlines specific demonstrable actions an issuer should take to prove reasonable care. First, making a reasonable inquiry into the purchaser's investment intent.
Like actually asking them.
Yes, actually asking them, are you buying this for your own portfolio or are you planning to resell it immediately? Second, providing written disclosure to every purchaser prior to the sale that the securities are unregistered and therefore heavily restricted from resale.
Okay, written notice.
And third, physically or electronically placing a restrictive legend on the certificate or document that evidences the securities.
The restrictive legend. It's essentially a giant stamp on the stock certificate that says, do not attempt to sell this on the open market.
Yes, it puts any future transfer agent or buyer on explicit legal notice that the asset is frozen by federal law.
Okay, so we've covered the individual rules, the headcounts, the paperwork, and the resale.
Right.
But now we need to talk about what happens when Sam tries to play games with the calendar. We need to discuss integration, or, as I like to think of it, the SEC's version of Voltron.
Voltron. Integration is a vital, historically complex concept. The core philosophy is that regulators will look at multiple, seemingly separate capital-raising offerings and ask, are these actually just one giant illegal plan of financing that the issuer chopped up into little pieces to dodge the dollar caps or headcount limits?
Let's illustrate this with a concrete example. We know Rule 504, the small offering exemption, has a strict $10 million cap. Let's say Sam desperately needs $16 million to build his factory. He knows he can't raise $16 million in a single Rule 504 deal.
Right, he'd be $6 million over.
So he comes up with what he thinks is a brilliant loophole. On Monday, he opens offering A and raises $8 million. He officially closes offering A on Tuesday. On paper, it was under the $10 million cap.
Flawless.
Then on Wednesday, he opens offering B to raise another $8 million. He closes it on Thursday. Again, on paper, offering B was under the $10 million cap. Sam thinks he's a genius who just outsmarted the federal government. What does the SEC say when they look at this?
The SEC says, nice try. The regulators will invoke the integration doctrine. They will look at offering A and offering B. They will see that Sam is selling the exact same class of stock at the exact same time for the exact same purpose of building his factory.
And then what?
They will take those two separate $8 million offerings and forcibly integrate them, like Voltron, into one single massive offering.
And what is the consequence of that forced integration?
The consequence is catastrophic for Sam. By integrating the two, the SEC dictates that Sam just conducted a single offering of $16 million that instantly blows past the $10 million cap of Rule 504.
So he's busted.
The exemption fails completely. Sam has just conducted a massive, unregistered public offering, and he is liable for all the penalties that come with it.
Yikes. So integration is terrifying because it can retroactively destroy exemptions you thought were perfectly safe.
Yeah.
But there has to be a way to know you are clear. Sam can't just be paralyzed forever, terrified that a deal he does in 2026 will be integrated with a deal he did in 2024.
He's not paralyzed. For decades, the SEC relied on a very murky five-factor test to determine integration, which drove lawyers crazy because it was so subjective.
I can imagine.
But in 2021, the SEC dramatically modernized the rules to provide clear, bright-line safe harbors. And the most revolutionary one is the 30-day safe harbor.
A bright-line rule. I love it. What is the mechanism?
It is wonderfully simple. The rule states that if there is a minimum gap of 30 calendar days between the termination of one offering and the commencement of another offering, they are mathematically shielded from being integrated.
Just 30 days. That feels incredibly short. So if Sam officially closes offering A on January 1st, and he waits patiently until February 2nd to launch offering B, the SEC is legally blocked from combining them.
Exactly. The 30 calendar day buffer acts as a firewall. It is the very first thing you should calculate on an exam question regarding integration.
Okay, but I smell a catch. The SEC never makes it that easy without a caveat. Let's mix the exemptions. What if offering A was the accredited only exemption under Rule 506C?
The noisy one.
Right. Sam bought his Times Square billboard. He ran his Facebook ads. He blasted the general public. He closes that offering. He waits his 31 days. Then he launches offering B. But offering B is a no solicitation private placement under Rule 506B, where he is legally required to remain completely silent.
Okay, I see where this is going.
The problem is his phone is ringing off the hook for offering B because everyone remembers the massive billboard he bought last month. Does the 30-day firewall still protect him?
You found the exact catch the SEC designed. There's a highly specific condition attached to the 30-day safe harbor when a private, no-solicitation offering follows an offering that allowed general solicitation.
What's the condition?
To use the safe harbor in that scenario, Sam must reasonably believe that for each individual purchaser in the new private offering, he either did not solicit them through the public ads from the first offering, or he had a pre-existing substantive relationship with them before the commencement of the new offering.
So he cannot use the noisy advertising of offering A as a covert lead generation tool to quietly funnel buyers into the silent offering B. That stops the bait and switch.
Precisely. It prevents issuers from functionally polluting a private offering with public advertising.
That makes total sense. Now, aside from the 30-day firewall, are there any scenarios where offerings never integrate, regardless of the timeline? Like, they could happen on the exact same day and the SEC still wouldn't care.
Yes, there are several automatic safe harbors based on the fundamental nature of the offerings. First, offers and sales made pursuant to an employee benefit plan or a written compensatory contract.
Like stock options.
Exactly. If Sam is issuing stock options to his engineers as a retention bonus, that will never be integrated with his efforts to raise external capital.
That tracks. Compensating employees is fundamentally different than raising capital. What else?
Regulation S offerings. These are specialized offerings made exclusively offshore to non-U.S. residents. The SEC dictates that offshore Regis offerings will never be integrated with domestic RegD offerings.
Makes sense. Different jurisdictions.
And finally, if Sam attempts a private placement, realizes it's failing, formally terminates it, and then decides to bite the bullet and file an S-1 for a fully registered public offering, the SEC generally will not integrate the failed private deal with the new registered deal, provided he follows specific cooling off procedures.
Okay, so that covers the structural engineering of these deals. Let's transition to the nightmare scenarios. What happens when the paperwork hits the fan? Because in the real world, things go wrong. Let's talk about Form D and the bad actor disqualifications. Sam finishes his offering. He raised his $10 million. The check's cleared. Is his regulatory burden over?
Not quite. He has a mandatory reporting duty. An issuer conducting a sale under any of the Regulation D exemptions we've discussed must file a formal notice with the SEC, known as Form D.
Form D. Okay, the exam loves administrative deadlines, so let's lock this in. What is the exact deadline to file this form?
Form D must be filed no later than 15 calendar days after the date of the very first sale of securities in the offering.
Note that language, listener. 15 calendar days. Not business days. The clock is ticking on weekends. So what happens if day 15 lands on a Sunday or a federal holiday?
In that specific scenario, the deadline is automatically pushed to the next ensuing business day.
How does Sam actually file this? Is he mailing a manila envelope to Washington, D.C.?
No, paper filings are dead. Form D must be filed electronically through the SEC's EJDAI system. EJDAI stands for the Electronic Data Gathering, Analysis, and Retrieval System. It's the central digital nervous system for SEC filings.
Direct question for the audience. Let's test your cross-topic knowledge.
Yeah.
Riley the rep works for a broker-dealer that is a FINRA/AML member firm. FINRA has its own massive rulebook, and they require broker-dealers to file private placement documents with them. If Riley's firm successfully completes the FINRA private placement filing for Sam's deal, does Sam still need to log into DGR and file Form D with the SEC? Give yourself 2 seconds. One, two.
Yes, he absolutely does.
Really?
Yes, this is a crucial jurisdictional distinction. FINRA and the SEC are different entities with different mandates. FINRA regulates the broker-dealer, the SEC regulates the issuer. Satisfying a FINRA corporate financing rule does not magically absolve the issuer of their federal statutory duty to file Form D. They are parallel tracks.
Good to know. Now, what happens if Sam files his Form D accurately on day 10, but a month later, the reality of the business changes? The data on the form is now stale. Does he have to go back into EDGR and update it?
He is required to amend the filing, but only in three specific scenarios. First, to correct a material mistake of fact or error in the previously filed notice. Second, to reflect a change in the information provided. And third, annually, on or before the anniversary of the original filing if the offering is continuously ongoing for more than a year.
Wait, any change in the information forces an amendment. What if the number of non-accredited investors was listed as 10, and 2 weeks later, another uncle buys in, pushing the number to 11?
The SEC isn't quite that pedantic. There are specific carve-outs. For example, you do not need to amend the form simply because the size of the offering changes by less than 10%, or because the number of non-accredited investors fluctuates. Provided, of course, it remains under the strict 35-person maximum for a Rule 506B deal.
Okay, that's a relief.
But if a change does trigger an amendment, you cannot just update the one single line item that changed. The rule requires you to update every single item on the form to its current status.
Okay, let's talk about the consequences of failure. What if Sam is just disorganized? He gets the money, he goes on vacation, and he forgets to file Form D until day 25. He is 10 days late. Does the SEC instantly nuke his entire Regulation D exemption because he missed the 15-day window?
This is a massive distinction for the exam, and it surprises a lot of people. Simply filing Form D late does not automatically destroy your federal exemption.
It doesn't.
No, it doesn't. However, the SEC has a very specific weapon to deal with chronic failure. It is called the injunction-based disqualification.
What is the mechanism of that disqualification?
The exemption becomes unavailable only if the issuer or its predecessors or affiliates is subject to a formal court order enjoining them for failure to comply with the Form D filing requirement.
Ah, so you literally need a federal judge to issue an injunction over the missing paperwork before the exemption dies. A mere administrative delay of a few days doesn't trigger the death penalty.
Correct. Form D is relatively forgiving in that specific regard, but there is another type of disqualification in Regulation D that is utterly unforgiving. It is a strict liability minefield. It is the bad actor disqualification.
The bad actors. This sounds ominous.
It is designed to be. The SEC wants to keep criminals out of the private markets. The bad actor disqualification strips the Reg D exemption away entirely if people connected to the offering have specific disqualifying events in their history. And the net the SEC casts to catch these people is incredibly wide.
Who gets caught in the net? Who are the covered persons?
The list is exhaustive. It covers the issuer itself. Any predecessor of the issuer, any affiliated issuer. It covers all directors, executive officers, general partners, and managing members of the issuer.
Anyone else?
It covers massive shareholders, anyone who beneficially owns 20% or more of the issuer's outstanding voting equity. It covers promoters. It covers any person who is being compensated for soliciting purchasers like Riley the rep. And if the issuer is a pooled investment fund, it covers the investment manager and their principals.
Exam trap alert. I am waving the red flag. Listen to this specific scenario because this is exactly how the test writers will try to confuse you. Hmm. Let's assume Sam's Toaster Company has a formal board of directors.
Okay.
One of the directors is a guy named Dave. Dave has a terrible track record. He was convicted of felony securities fraud a few years ago. But Dave knows he's toxic. So Dave takes a formal leave of absence. He moves to a cabin in the woods. He has absolutely nothing to do with Sam's new Regulation D offering. He doesn't vote on it. He doesn't read the documents. He doesn't talk to investors. He is totally isolated.
A literal hermit.
Yes, a hermit.
Kid.
Because Dave did not participate in the offering, Is Sam's exemption safe?
No. Sam's exemption is dead on arrival.
Why? Dave didn't touch the deal.
Because of Dave's title.
Yeah.
A director or an executive officer is classified as a covered person whether or not they participated in the offering. The SEC views the boardroom as the brain of the company. If the brain is tainted by a bad actor, the entire entity is tainted. Only lower-level personnel, classified as other officers, are shielded by the phrase, who participates in the offering. Dave is a director. His mere presence on the roster triggers the disqualification, regardless of his day-to-day isolation.
Wow. So the tone at the top dictates the survival of the exemption. What kind of historical events actually label someone a bad actor?
It is a vast array of regulatory and criminal failures, felony or misdemeanor convictions in connection with the purchase or sale of a security, court injunctions restraining someone from engaging in securities practices, final orders from state regulators barring someone from the industry, SEC disciplinary orders, suspensions or expulsions from FENNR or a national securities exchange.
Wait, I heard a rumor that the post office can ruin your Reg D exemption. Is that an urban legend?
It is entirely true. Yeah. If a covered person is subject to a United States Postal Service false representation order, that triggers the bad actor disqualification. Mail fraud is historically deeply intertwined with securities fraud, so the SEC explicitly included it.
But how far back in time does the SEC look? Is this a lifetime ban? If Dave did something stupid when he was 22 and now he is a 60-year-old pillar of the community, is he still permanently blacklisted from Reg D?
There are statutory look-back periods. It is not a lifetime ban. For criminal felony or misdemeanor convictions, the look-back period is generally 10 years.
Why did I read that it was 5 years in some study guide?
Because there is a trap inside the rule. The look-back is 10 years for almost everyone on that massive list of covered persons. Except for the issuer itself, its predecessors, and affiliated issuers. For the corporate entity itself, the criminal look-back is only 5 years.
That feels backwards. Why does the corporation get a shorter penalty box than the individual director?
The regulatory philosophy is that corporations change over time. If a company commits a crime, clears out its entire corrupt management team, installs an independent board, and operates cleanly for 5 years, the SEC believes capital formation shouldn't be permanently choked off.
Ah, I see.
But an individual human being who commits securities fraud, the SEC wants them out of the game for a full decade.
That makes a lot of sense. So 10 years for individuals, 5 years for the issuer. Are there any other time frame tricks we need to know?
Yes, the grandfather dates. This is a crucial timeline cutoff you absolutely must memorize. September 23, 2013 for the uncapped exemptions and January 20, 2017 for the small offering exemption.
What do those specific dates represent?
Those are the dates the bad actor rules officially went into effect.
Yeah.
The SEC decided not to apply the disqualification retroactively. If a bad actor event occurred before the relevant grandfather date, it does not destroy the exemption.
So if Dave got his felony conviction in 2010, the offering can proceed.
The offering can proceed. The exemption remains intact. But the SEC doesn't just let you sweep it under the rug.
What do you have to do?
For those pre-cutoff grandfathered events, the issuer is legally required to disclose the event in writing to every single purchaser a reasonable time prior to the sale. You keep your exemption, but you are forced to air your dirty laundry to the investors and let them decide if they still want to hand you their money.
Okay, we've talked about deliberate fraud and bad actors.
Yeah.
But what if Sam isn't a criminal? What if Sam is just a slightly sloppy administrator?
It happens.
Let's say Sam is running a flawless $50 million private placement, but his lawyer makes a tiny, mathematically insignificant paperwork error on one single disclosure document sent to one single investor. Does that minor deviation cause the entire $50 million exemption to collapse, forcing him to refund everyone's money?
The SEC recognized that private placements are incredibly complex, multi-party logistical nightmares. If one microscopic administrative slip sank a massive deal, the collateral damage to innocent investors and employees would be catastrophic.
Right.
To prevent that, the SEC created a narrow, highly specific defense. It is formally called the insignificant deviations rule. I prefer to call it the oops clause.
The oops clause. How does Sam qualify to use it?
It requires passing a strict three-prong test. Sam can preserve his exemption for a particular purchaser if he can prove all three of these elements.
Let's hear them.
Prong one. The failure to comply did not pertain to a term, condition, or requirement directly intended to protect that particular entity or individual. Prong two. The failure to comply was insignificant with respect to the offering as a whole. And prong three, Sam made a good faith, reasonable attempt to comply with all applicable terms, conditions, and requirements.
Let's test that with a hypothetical. Let's say a specific SEC rule required Sam to print a risk disclosure on page 4 of his prospectus in 12-point font. But his commercial printer glitches, and it prints the disclosure in 11.5-point font. It is technically a violation of the rule.
That is a perfect application of the oops clause. Let's run the test. Prong 1. A half-point reduction in font size was not specifically designed to harm or protect one specific reader. Prong 2. An 11.5-point font is mathematically insignificant to the overarching economic reality of a $50 million offering. Prong 3. Sam sent the correct file to the printer. It was a mechanical error, demonstrating his good faith attempt to comply. Sam passes all three prongs. The exemption survives.
But, and this is a massive, dramatic pivot for the listener, there are limits to the oops clause. It is not a get-out-of-jail-free card for everything. We have arrived at the climax of Regulation D. The SEC explicitly carved out three fundamental rules that are so foundational they are immune to the insignificant deviations defense. I call them the three unforgivable curses of Reg D. They are the structural pillars of the exemption framework. If you break one of these three pillars, the oops clause cannot save you, no matter how minor the deviation looks on a spreadsheet.
Walk us through the three unforgivable sins. Number one, the ban on general solicitation under Rule 506B and 504. If you were legally required to remain silent and your marketing intern accidentally sends a mass email blast to a public mailing list, you cannot claim it was an insignificant deviation. The ban is absolute.
Wow. Okay. What's number two?
Number two, the aggregate offering price limit in the small offering exemption, the $10 million cap. If you accidentally calculate your rolling 12-month window incorrectly and you raise $10 million once, you cannot argue, oops, it's just a single dollar, it's insignificant to the whole. The SEC views the dollar cap as a hard, impenetrable ceiling.
We have a third curse.
Number three, the purchaser limit in a no-solicitation private placement. The 35 non-accredited purchasers. If Sam miscounts his spreadsheets, fails to verify a household properly, and accidentally issues stock to purchaser number 36, the oops clause is void. The cap is the cap.
So synthesize that for me. What is the takeaway?
The takeaway is that the SEC will forgive administrative sloppiness, but they will never forgive a breach of the core mechanics. You can mess up the margins on a disclosure document. You can accidentally mail a brochure a day late to someone who didn't even read it. But you absolutely cannot sneak in a 36th unaccredited investor.
Or run a public ad.
Right. You cannot run a public advertisement when you promised silence. Mm. And you cannot exceed the hard dollar limit. Break any of those three, and your exemption collapses instantly.
And just to clarify, if Sam does successfully use the oops clause to save his exemption from a minor paperwork error, does that mean he is totally innocent?
No, and that's a great nuance. The insignificant deviations rule saves the registration exemption so the deal doesn't collapse. But the underlying technical failure remains actionable. The SEC can still bring an enforcement action against Sam for the specific technical violation, even though the offering itself survives.
Okay. We have covered an immense amount of ground today. We started with the brick wall of the 1933 Act. We navigated the dollar caps, the headcounts, the integrations, and the bad actors. Let's finish strong with a rapid-fire recap of the absolute most testable metrics. I'm going to fire the concept. You fire the core takeaway. Ready?
Ready.
Concept one. What does Regulation D actually exempt?
Registration only. It does not exempt anti-fraud provisions. You can bypass the paperwork, but you can still go to prison for lying to investors.
Concept two, the small offering exemption, Rule 504.
Capped at exactly $10 million over a rolling 12-month period. The aggregate price calculation must include non-cash items like property, services, and debt cancellation. Blank check companies are permanently banned.
Concept three, the no solicitation exemption, Rule 506B.
Unlimited capital allowed. Absolute ban on general solicitation. You are allowed an unlimited number of accredited investors, but capped at a maximum of 35 non-accredited sophisticated purchasers in any 90 calendar day window.
Concept four, the accredited only exemption, Rule 506C.
The seesaw flips. General solicitation and public advertising are fully permitted, but in exchange, zero non-accredited investors are allowed. The issuer bears the affirmative burden to take reasonable steps to verify the accredited status of every single buyer.
Concept five, the Form D filing.
Must be filed electronically on ADGR no later than 15 calendar days after the first sale. It is a completely separate statutory requirement from FINRA broker-dealer filings.
Concept six, the unforgivable curses.
The insignificant deviations cure will never save you if you violate the general solicitation ban, the aggregate dollar cap, or the 35 purchaser maximum.
Incredible. That is the mechanical core of Regulation D.
Yeah.
But before we sign off, I want to leave the listener with a broader thought to chew on, something that bridges the gap between exam memorization and the real-world evolution of finance.
Consider the definition of an accredited investor. The entire architecture of Regulation D, especially the protections built into the no solicitation rules, is heavily predicated on wealth thresholds, specifically $200,000 in annual income or a $1 million net worth. Those specific numbers were established by the SEC decades ago.
And inflation has fundamentally altered the math since then.
Exactly. $200,000 in income meant something vastly different in the 1980s than it does today. As inflation continuously pushes asset prices and nominal wages higher, a growing percentage of the American public is technically crossing the threshold into accredited status simply through the inflated value of their retirement accounts and real estate, not necessarily through an increase in actual financial sophistication.
It's a huge point.
Right. This raises a fascinating structural question. In the coming decades, will the protective limits of Rule 506B, the restriction on unsophisticated retail investors, become functionally obsolete simply because everyone technically becomes an accredited millionaire on paper? It forces the SEC into a constant philosophical battle, continually reevaluating the tension between allowing startups to access capital efficiently and preventing the masses from getting crushed in unregulated private markets.
It's a massive shift. The legal guardrails are static, but the economic reality is constantly moving underneath them. All right, we have reached the end of the deep dive. We've mapped the terrain. You know exactly where Sam the sponsor can step to raise his millions and exactly where he falls off the cliff into federal enforcement. Don't just memorize the numbers. Remember the why behind them. And those trick questions won't stand a chance. You have the tools to crush function one of this Series 82. Thank you for taking this deep dive with us. Keep grinding through the material, and we will see you on the next one.